Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. The European green crab was introduced to North America in the early 1800s, arriving in the ballasts of ships. Historically, the green crab population was kept in check by cold winter water temperatures. With climate change and warming ocean waters, the green crab population has exploded in the Gulf of Maine and in the waters off the Cape and Islands. Green crabs feast on juvenile shellfish and have the capacity to wipe out shellfish beds and decimate eelgrass beds. Coastal communities from Maine down the eastern seaboard are trying different strategies to manage the green crabs and protect shellfishing. One Bad Crab is a film by Sandy Cannon Brown, shining a light on the efforts underway on Martha's Vineyard. And joining us are some of the vineyarders featured in the film. Emma Green Beach is executive director of the Martha's Vineyard Shellfish Group. Hi, Emma.
Hi there. How are you this morning?
Great. And Rob Morrison's Edgartown Shellfish Constable. Hi, Rob.
Good morning.
And Nelson Siegelman, writer and all-around outdoorsman who works in the summer for the Tisbury Shellfish and Harbor Departments. He also narrates the One Bad Crab film. Welcome back, Nelson. Good to see you.
Yes, thank you.
So, Nelson, for listeners who have never heard of the European green crab, give us a sense of this species. What's their native habitat and life cycle in their native habitat?
Well, I think I have to defer a little bit to the biologists here because I wrote about them, but I'm not that familiar with their life cycle, but I can tell you that they thrive in some areas of the vineyard and have proven to be quite a problem for people who are interested in shellfish resources. I first became aware of them working for the shellfish department because we trapped them. And I was surprised at the numbers I was seeing. And it just in all sizes, too, from really small green crabs that might be about a half an inch or an inch in size to green crabs that are about 6 or 7 inches across, fully grown.
Where is their native habitat? Where would that be? And we see them now in a lot of places all around the world, right?
Correct. Yeah. So these green crabs are an invasive species, and I believe they originated from Europe. They came over allegedly in ballast water in ships. And the thing that makes green crabs so tenacious is their ability to adapt to pretty much any environment. They're at home anywhere they are, and they're voracious predators. They eat everything, including baby shellfish, which is the main problem for myself and people that are trying to run a municipal shellfish program. They also love to consume shellfish habitat and eelgrass. So particularly challenging, they can adapt to live basically anywhere they arrive, and they eat everything in their path. So those are basically our issues. And we think they came from Europe, but they've spread all over North America on the east and west coast. They even have some in Australia, I understand. So they've spread all around the world and left problems in their wake, basically.
So as you mentioned, they arrived in the early 1800s. So they've been in this ecosystem for over 100 years. Emma, when did we start to recognize they were becoming problematic in our waters?
You know, that's a great question. And I think that would probably vary a lot between communities, because, you know, one of the challenges is looking back into time and wondering, well, were we looking? So it's definitely been, it's been a couple decades, but as will be discussed in the film just a little bit, is the way the weather patterns change. And, you know, this is what we see with all sorts of other nuisance pests and diseases and insects, right? When we have nice cold winters, or the weather is the way it's, you know, supposed to be, things stay in a certain cycle. And then when we get warm periods or extra cold periods, things shift again. So the green crabs have been around for, yes, like a long time. But it's been a couple decades that they've been really increasing. And one thing that I've found really interesting as we've, you know, been working with Sandy and talking more and more about green crabs with people from, you know, from off island, not just each other, is also where they tend to be and where they're not seen as much. Like Rob mentioned that they're don't seem to be as many green crabs in Katama Bay because the bottom's a little bit different. They can adapt to wherever they want to be. And they're also, anecdotally, I've heard they're pretty smart too, which was another thing that makes them like a really good invader to just figure out how to get along wherever they end up. And so we find them all over the place. Right. So are we seeing more of them now because we're just looking more? But there really does seem to be a really big insurgence. And as as they discuss in the film, even though the towns who are trapping them constantly, they just keep coming.
And with the winters have been warm. We've had some pretty warm winters. And Nelson, you and I were talking before the show that we've had a little bit of cold here. We'll see what happens, right? Is this cold enough, right, to make an impact? We don't know yet, right?
When I was writing the story, I went back. I started looking, trying to correlate temperature with scallop harvest in Tisbury, and it started to go beyond my technical capabilities. But I thought it would be really interesting to correlate, try and correlate that, and go back because I know in Tisbury our scallop harvest the has just this year it's been pretty good, but in recent years it hadn't been, and I wondered what the correlation was with the climate and the weather.
Rob, talk about what shellfish we find in local waters. We have what, clams, softshell clams, bay scallops, quahogs. What are we trying to protect from these green crabs?
Yeah, so the shellfish species that are under my purview in the town of Edgartown are, yeah, the ones you've listed, softshell clams, what people know as steamer clams, quahogs, which are the hard shell clams, bay scallops, which is big news right now. We're in right in the midst of a scallop season in Edgartown, and oysters. That's there are other shellfish species around, but those are the ones that are of commercial and recreational importance in Edgartown and in most towns on the island.
And once they get to a certain size, then they get too big for the green crabs, right? So it's really the juvenile shellfish species you're trying to protect, right?
More or less, yeah. Basically, what we do with our municipal propagation program in collaboration with the shellfish group is we get baby shellfish from the shellfish group, and we try to grow them to a size where they're able to fend on their own, basically, that where they're big enough to resist green crab predation and other predators. So basically, the bigger we can grow these shellfish, the quickest we can, we jumpstart their first growing season of life, and just try to get them big enough where they're resistant to predators. You're not going to save every last one of them, that's for sure, something I found out through experience, but the more of a leg up you can give them, so to speak, the better off they stand to do. And also, not just growing them to a certain size, but it matters a lot. I've found through trial and error and experience where you plant them as well. They need to be planted in an area where they're going to be resistant to predation and other mortality factors.
Yeah, we'll talk a little about that. But Emma, listeners might not realize that our local shellfish get a huge helping hand from hatcheries such as the Martha's Vineyard Shellfish Group, and then a big lift from town shellfish constables. So, Emma, explain the role of the Martha's Vineyard Shellfish Group and what species you're propagating.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure. So, the Shellfish Group is a nonprofit that was started in 1976 and really constructed in a way that the board of directors of the Martha's Vineyard Shellfish Group consists of all of the shellfish constables on the vineyard and then another representative from each town. So we're this like quasi, regional body looking out for the shellfish resources across the entire island. And we now run three facilities. We have a home-based hatchery on the lagoon on the Vineyard Haven side. We run the former state lobster hatchery in Oak Bluffs as a shellfish hatchery now. And we also have a nursery on Chappaquiddick that we lease from the Martha's Vineyard Land Bank. And so we grow quahogs, oysters, and bay scallops primarily for all of the towns. West Tisbury only gets oysters because they unfortunately don't have any habitat in West Tisbury for quahogs or for bay scallops. We do some other species like surf clams and ribbed mussels and blue mussels for research here and there. And so then all of the towns are members of the Shellfish Group. They pay a flat membership fee, and it's kind of in like a community supported agriculture model that they pay a flat fee and we bust our butts to grow as many baby shellfish as we can and distribute them evenly to all the towns. And then the constables get to pick their favorite way to grow them in the ponds and the locations that they select and the methods that they select to be best for their spots, and then plant them out where they have found to be the best for people to harvest. And so we're doing all this work for ecological restoration, just because bivalves are good for the water. They're filtering the water and moving energy through the systems. And then also for commercial harvesters to be able to gather, and also families and subsistence harvesters to be able to have access to like wild food.
And
So we
what
do this all
stage?
together.
Yeah, at what life stage are the shellfish passed along to the town shellfish constables? Because I mean, they're really tiny in the beginning, right?
They're tiny. And that's a strategy that, we sort of we've developed over time, and we reassess constantly. In order for us to do, 30 million plus seed every year, we send them to the constables at, they're between about a millimeter and maybe 4 millimeters, depending on the species and the time of year and things like that. So yeah, they're very small. But to be able to grow them inside the hatchery to a bigger size, that our numbers would go down, exponentially. So it's sort of this give and take. And so the towns need to find their favorite ways, like I said, to grow these and keep them safe till they're a little bit bigger. And in the early days of the Shellfish Group, the town departments weren't as evolved as they are now in their propagation. So the Shellfish Group did grow seed to a bigger size, but grew much fewer of them. So again, that's a model that we're always, talking about and sort of reassessing as necessary.
So, Rob, you get what are the next steps? You get this the juvenile shellfish that you receive, and then you figure out like you're obviously putting them in different environments, right? So, how do you determine like you got the bay scallops and you get the clams? You're figuring out which bodies of water to put them in, and what do you just scatter them about?
It's I guess I could talk all day about the nuance of that really. And it really depends on the species and things that work. So just as a overview, I showed up on the scene on the shellfish department in Edgartown about 14 years ago, and it was a really good time in the evolution of grow out for the shellfish department, in the sense that I had people surrounding me that really knew what they were doing and had a lot of experience. I worked with Warren Gaines for the last 12 years. He just retired last year, and Warren already knew where everything grew the best, the techniques that worked the best. He just needed help to execute all of this. So I followed his lead on the best growing techniques and areas and everything, and just we threw some more labor at the situation, and that had been productive. I also had the ability to learn a lot from Jack Blake, who was kind of one of the founders of aquaculture in Katama Bay. Aquaculturists get paid by the piece for their shellfish they grow. They grow oysters. So, the people that are getting paid by the piece instead of like by the hour, like I do, need to grow shellfish in the best. So if you take their techniques and listen to them and kind of elaborate on those afterwards, that was an excellent foundation for me to step into, learning from those people and many others. So basically I took that and ran with it, and we've been able to see a good result as a result of that and collaborating with the shellfish group. But make a long story a little bit longer. It depends on the shellfish species that you're growing, your methods. We use a tidal upwellers in a couple of locations, which are big funnels that push water through these screened bins and help these really small, like millimeter, 1.5 millimeter shellfish get a really good jump start. It kind of force feeds them. It pushes a lot of food by them in the water. It redistributes them on the tide cycle so they can have uniform and productive growth. And then we'll finish them out in different apparatus based on the species. We grow out oysters and scallops in these bottom cages. We grow quahogs and floating quahog pens. So it just depends on the species. methods we use.
So 14 years, what have you seen over that 14 years in terms of how the green crabs have changed what's happening here in the waters? Has it been like a steady rise, or what have you seen?
I think it's been fairly consistent. Honestly, the approach I use to green crabs is I do a very limited predator control program. We focus more of our time on growing shellfish better, which you'll see in the film, just because that's been productive. We do a predator control program for green crabs, but it's not extensive. I think our time is better spent growing these shellfish to size, planning. It's better spent on growing things instead of killing things, basically. You can kill all the green crabs you want. It doesn't seem to make that much
So
of a
you're never
difference.
going to get them all, right? Yeah, just no
Them
way.
all
Yeah. Yeah.
in. I support killing green crabs, but there's only so many hours in the day to do that, and that
There's a
doesn't seem like
lot of them, right? We're talking about green crabs this morning. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about green crabs this morning, which feast on juvenile shellfish. They have the capacity to wipe out shellfish beds and decimate eelgrass beds. Coastal communities from Maine down the eastern seaboard are trying different strategies to manage the green crabs and protect shellfishing. One Bad Crab is a film by Sandy Cannon Brown, and she's shining a light on the efforts underway on Martha's Vineyard in Maine. And with us are some of the folks featured in the film: Emma Green Beach, executive director of the Martha's Vineyard Shellfish Group; Rob Morrison, Edgartown Shellfish Constable; Nelson Siegelman, who in the summer works for the Tisbury Shellfish and Harbor Departments and also narrates the One Bad Crab film. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to chime in. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. You mentioned, Rob, some of the different ways that you try to protect the shellfish, using trays, bags, boxes, even gravel, which I thought was really interesting in the film to see. You put them in, or some people put them in with the gravel, and the crabs don't want to mix through the gravel to get to them. Is that the idea?
That's all Warren Gaines' brainchild, and it works. If you plant baby quahogs mostly in areas that are gravelly on the bottom. One of their main predators in Katama Bay is the lady crab that burrows through the sand to feed on these small quahogs. If you plant them in naturally gravelly areas, they don't want to burrow through the sand, and they get kind of tired of, sorting through pea-sized gravel that's the same size as quahogs, and they give up and go somewhere else. So we've seen great success in using the areas we plant the quahogs in to help them survive. And that's something you see in nature. If you rate quahogs, quahogs survive really well around other bigger quahogs, and you also naturally will see more in kind of a type of bottom that's naturally gravelly, because it's just provides natural protection from predators like green crabs or lady crabs. So that's something we've seen success with.
It's interesting to see all these different strategies that everybody tries. And Nelson, in the film, I think you had one where you took two trays and you put a screen on one. Tell us about that and what the results were.
Yes, well, when I was writing that story, I found a dissertation by this fellow Bill Walton, who is from the Cape originally, and he ended up getting his doctorate. And interestingly, did all his research on Martha's Vineyard about green crabs, so it was a real find. And he talked about trapping, just as Rob said, it can be effective, but in his research, he found that it was really most effective during a very limited amount of time. So, not really knowing anything about this, I took two trays and I counted out 100 small seed quahogs that we'd raised in our bins. They were probably about a quarter inch in size, maybe a half inch at the biggest. I put 100 in one tray, and I put 100 in another, and I put a screen or a net over one of the trays. And it was really exciting, actually, after about a season and a half, to find that tray that had a net over it, the quahogs had really survived well. I think I still had about 85, and they'd grown to a pretty good size. And the tray without the net only had about 50 or fewer quahogs, and they were about the same size. I mean, netting is very effective, but it's very labor intensive. I know on the Cape, on those big flats out there, where the departments that work are really, they go gangbusters because you've got such a robust commercial fishery out there. But it's a lot of work to net areas. But it was interesting to see the result. I also used a large net working with the other folks, Danny Ewart, the constable, and with a lot of support from other people, we tried that with one very big net. And again, it was really surprising how well the quahogs survive. But you just can't net all of these areas because it's you also have to keep the net clean. It starts to get fouled, so there's a lot of work to it. But you can use traps selectively, and that will help you protect limited areas. But these green crabs are so hardy. We would trap them, and then we'd bring them to an area at the Tisbury Public Works area where they would turn them into compost. Basically, we'd dump the crabs, and then they mix them with leaves and that sort of thing. Well, on one particular day, it was pretty rainy out. We dumped the crabs, and then later I heard that a crab had actually made its way, and this is a couple of football fields, made its way down to where the dog pound is, where the dog officer is, and she's got a soft spot for everything. And apparently she saw this crab, and she picked it up and she brought it back to the water and put it back in Tashmoo. And I imagine this, cartoon where the next week we do this, about 18 crabs are making their way down to the dog officer's building, and because they'd spread the word. But they are amazingly
And probably was a female, right? In the film, you see like why there's so many of them. They have hundreds and hundreds of eggs, right? And so you just because it's impossible to get them all. Bonnie and Brewster has a question. She says, "Is it possible to harvest the crabs and use them as food for some other species?" Yes, they do, right? I mean, we find out we use them for bait, and there are actually chefs who are looking. There's a market for green crabs in some restaurants, right? Who wants to talk about that?
Sure. I would love to. Yeah, and I had a nice conversation with Mary Parks from greencrab.org, who's also featured in the film. And they're putting greencrab.org is putting in a lot of effort into educating chefs in the food market into using green crabs, because there have always been a few chefs around in America who valued green crabs, and so trying to spread that word. And I've eaten them. I've cooked them a little bit. And yeah, they're yummy. They don't have as much meat as a blue crab. They're not a swimming crab. They don't have that really nice lump meat like in the back of the carapace, but they have a great crab flavor. And they also have really good marine nutritional aspects. So, as I guess as I think a lot about this, the green crabs and removing them, and is the trapping worth it? And is eating them worth it? And is it going to actually reduce numbers? It's like, you know what? This is a super invasive species that has a really great nutritional profile. That is a new could be a fun ingredient. And if we can take them out of the water, help save a few baby shellfish, save a little bit of eelgrass, feed some people, use them as bait for tautog or for the conch fishery. Yes, some aquariums and that keep different types of, I know that like octopus, other cephalopods like to eat crabs. They can be used as food sources for other animals. They can be used as compost and as fertilizer. We could do a lot of cool things with green crabs that would help to achieve like a whole bunch of our sustainability goals as like a community. So I just think there's a lot of cool things we could do.
Talk a little bit, maybe this question for you, Rob, how the green crabs impact the eelgrass beds and why this is a problem.
Eelgrass beds are basically the foundation of a lot of our shellfish populations, for all of them, but bay scallops in particular. It provides a place to hide for the juveniles. They have Bissell threads on them, which they attach to the blades of eelgrass, and they can kind of hide from predators in the mix. Eelgrass is also a really important part of the health of the ponds and the ecosystem, as it involves the nitrogen cycle and the carbon cycle and producing oxygen for the water. So important for all of those reasons. So green crabs kind of mechanically remove eelgrass blades as they're foraging for food. So yeah, it can be devastating on eelgrass, but also eelgrass is challenged in a lot of other environmental ways, warming waters. As waters get too warm, the eelgrass can't respirate. So we're seeing a coastwide decline of eelgrass, and green crabs are just kind of one
One of them, yeah,
piece of.
nitrogen loading, warming waters, green crabs. Is the threat to the eelgrass a confluence of all of these factors, or is one more of a problem than the others?
I'll let Emma take this one, but I think it's a combination of all of them, really.
I think that we just have to say it's a combination of them. I think that, you know, there are definitely some, there are probably some eelgrass researchers who might be able to weigh the different threats, but warming waters is definitely a really huge one, and one of the ones that's out of our immediate control, you know. And when we're talking about the different threats, say to eelgrass, is it, maybe there were green crabs around decades ago, and they were plucking out, you know, maybe they were eating the seedlings as they were germinating in the spring, and they were pulling it out and eating it, and maybe they were interacting with the eelgrass, but the eelgrass wasn't as stressed by heat, by the sun and by the warming water temperatures, so it could tolerate the grazing and the disturbance from the crabs. But now that there are all these other things going on, each threat is magnified. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. So if we didn't seed shellfish and protect them through the early stages of life, would we even have a shellfishery in our local waters if we weren't doing that?
I'll speak to that a little bit if you want. Yes, we would. But I see now nature needs more help than it ever did. So we've through our programs, our collaboration with the Shellfish Group, and I'd be really remiss if I didn't mention my awesome staff that I have. They do all the heavy lifting. It's not just me. So thank you, Jason, Chuck, Julie, Ralph, Ron. You guys are awesome. And it really takes all that hard work and all those hours and all that labor of growing these shellfish and planting them. So we have seen what one of the things that motivates us is the results we've seen through this. We drive a commercial and recreational oyster fishery in Sinjacantacket. There's people out there today making a living off of oysters that we planted out there that wouldn't be there if the shellfish department didn't do that. We've also seen a big shift in our recreational commercial fisheries for quahogs and bay scallops. So it's those results that drive us. So we have seen improvement in some areas. If you go down to Katama Bay on a low tide on a Saturday, Ron will check your license and you'll see a lot of people catching full limits of quahogs if they want to. So that's a fishery that we've definitely not only supplemented but really created there. But there are existing we can't take all the credit, and it definitely helps. We helps the subsidize these populations, but it's also up to nature. There has to be, you know, the conditions have to exist that allow these shellfish to flourish, and that can be a moving target. So it definitely helps, but we can't take all the credit, that's for sure.
Go ahead, Emma.
And I would add that it across the island, there are some areas where, yes, the bay scallops, the quahogs naturally occur and recruit year after year. And then there are some areas where the water quality is not as good, or the disturbances are more so. And those areas that are disturbed even more, I feel like they tend to be the more shallow areas, the areas that are more accessible, say, to like family harvesters. And so where the shellfish departments, I think, probably have the most impact is where, like, the area that the Rob was just describing in Katama Bay, where it's a shallow area where the families can go. And so without the towns doing what they're doing, there probably wouldn't be as much recreational harvest.
How are other communities along the eastern seaboard managing their shell fishery alongside the green crabs? I mean, that's sort of, you're trying all these different strategies, and I imagine you're looking and seeing what other people are doing and what's working where, right? So what are some of the things other communities are doing that's of interest maybe to us here or makes sense?
Well, I think netting is, at least when I attended the there's a shellfish constables get together annually, and I know the last time when I went to that, it seemed as though netting was a big part of the Cape communities where that happens. And during some of the research I was doing, I didn't come across a lot of predator control programs in some of the other communities that I was looking at. There was a study, it was done in California, and they really did an intensive trapping program. And what happened was after 5 years, there was an explosion of green crabs because they had removed all of these adult green crabs, which also feed on the young, their own young. And it allowed the population to just explode. Mm-hmm. So there, you know, other communities have tried this. There was one up in Nova Scotia, which really, the water body was about the size of Tashmu on the vineyard. And they did, again, an intensive trapping program. But it costs so much money. And it was really quite expensive. But it did allow the softshell clams to come back in measurable numbers. So, you know, you can trap, it seems, and some communities do it, but it's expensive and time consuming.
Yeah. We see,
and one of the ways to getting more trapping done is these like public private partnerships, right? Where you have, if there were more fishermen who wanted to trap green crabs in order to use it for bait, then that would be a way that it wouldn't fall on the town departments and like the taxpayers. And so if we can get more creative, then we could get more done.
Right. We are, talk to Eric, who's giving us a call. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Mindy. This is a great show. I've noticed kind of anecdotally in intertidal areas around the Cape that where I used to see a predominance of green crabs, I'm seeing much more of the Asian shore crabs. And you know, an even more recent invasive species. And I'm curious to know if there's any shift that's been measured or noted away from green crabs to other more recent invasives, or even how blue crabs might factor in more heavily as water temperatures continue to rise and their habitat might be more conducive to spreading further north.
Right. Eric, that's a really good question, because in the film, you do see blue crabs in local waters, but they aren't as common, right, as the green crab. But it is mentioned that we could see more blue crabs, and normally you don't, when you have the blue crabs, you have less of the green crabs. Rob, is this a question for you? But then we have a problem with the blue crabs, right? Potentially.
Yeah, I'd be happy to speak to this. Basically, different crab species seem to like different habitats. Edgartown has several different ponds. We have a lot of different bodies of water that are unique, each one of them. Where I see most of the green crabs is Sendjikintakit. They seem to have a habitat they enjoy there, and there's plenty for them to eat. Not that I don't see them in Cape Pogue or Katama, but I do. We don't see a lot of these Asian shore crabs here, and I think that might be habitat-driven. It could be also that the green crabs are out competing them. I went to school on Mount Hope Bay in Bristol, Rhode Island, at Roger Williams University. Their habitat was a lot different there. It was a very rocky shoreline. If you tipped over a rock on Mount Hope Bay, you'd see 50 Asian shore crabs under it. So I think it could be just habitat, and just the makeup of the ecosystem could account for the different crab populations in each body of water. Also, yeah, the blue crabs, as the water shifts, we do have a pretty robust blue claw crab population here, and that's very cyclical. I don't know if it's necessarily tied to some of the other species, but we do see them very abundant cyclically here.
Emma?
I was going to add that we were pulling cages off the dock of the shellfish group just last week, looking for some little quahogs that we are overwintering. And we found quite a few Asian shore crabs. A couple of them were huge females. And I've worked at the shellfish group for the better part of like 20 years, and this is relatively new. I don't know. In this area of the lagoon, like there is, it is somewhat rocky. I don't know if this is something that maybe we'll only see them in the wintertime more, but I was really surprised. And every time I pulled up another one, I was shouting about it because we did not used to see them. So, but I personally don't know how the Asian shore crab will interact with the shellfish species. I don't know how they are exactly as a predator. We know that they're, another very successful invader that, like Rob said, I went to school at UMass Dartmouth and we went to Bristol, Rhode Island to go study the Asian shore crabs under the rock. And so we don't know how that's going to play out. And yes, we've had a lot of blue crabs the past couple of years. As Rob said, it's cyclical, so we don't really know yet how they're going to, how they're going to compete with each other. But through these conversations, I hadn't really heard before, hadn't really thought much about it, maybe that down in the Chesapeake, where they have lots of blue crabs, they don't have a lot of green crabs, or they don't seem to be a problem. Or it's not a problem they worry about somewhere in, in that realm. So there's just a lot of interesting interactions for us to be keeping track of. And we don't really have a really robust monitoring program on the vineyard, besides what the cons you know what the towns are doing for their trapping. So
So,
maybe it's something to be keeping track of.
yeah, stay tuned for that. All right, let's talk to Tor, who's giving us a call. Hi, Tor.
Yeah, hi there, Mindy. I have some nice observations to share. The green crab, who's also known as Carcinus maenas, a fancy scientific name, has been around for quite a long time. When I was young, say fourth grade, 1954, first time saw the Cape, our house on the shoreline in North Truro, we had a wonderful bed of Uvalactuca, the green sea lettuce, a place where the fishermen, the striped bass fishermen would go with their rakes and turn over rocks to get sea worms. It seemed to be a complete ecosystem in those years. So the green crabs are quite prevalent, all their places to hide and mussels to feed on. And then off of the breakwater in Provincetown, at low tide, you could often find the shells of the green crab deceased, anchored by the byssus lines of the blue mussels and the barnacles and all that would be part of the tide pool life. Also, I would say this was a time when biodiversity was more complete. There's a wonderful illustration in the Time Life book called The World We Live In, a fold out that shows how the pier pilings in those days when it was the halcyon grandeur of biodiversity, that all the creatures that make up the food web, including all the many crabs, were in a kind of a holding pattern that worked wonderfully to create what was the halcyon grandeur. Now, jumping to today's research, you were asking about the green crab and the quahog. So I'm actually reading from what is in Wikipedia and Google, where there are very good articles published with the Center for Coastal Studies. And this would be to Owen Nichols, who is actually conducting trapping and other methods of studying a green crab in Pleasant Bay and other estuaries around the Cape, says that shellfish committee members say green crabs appear to be far more prevalent now than in past years. Asian crabs in a productive area near the lighthouse, as you've seen. Now, it says that green crabs don't seem to target quahogs except as a last resort.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Tor, thanks. I got to cut you off there because we don't have much time left here to go. I just want to, Emma, you said you had tried eating green crab. Rob or Nelson, have you tried it?
I've tried it.
And?
It's not bad.
Okay. Nelson, have you tried it?
No, I prefer the blue claws. If I'm going to spend that much time, I'd rather eat a blue claw. Mindy, one thing I did want to mention is that the Tisbury Waterways Inc. sponsored this film, and they're a nonprofit, And they spend a lot of time and energy supporting these kind of efforts.
Right. And we should say the One Bad Crab premieres Sunday, March 9th, 4 p.m. at the Film Center in Vineyard Haven. And there'll be a discussion and reception. And we'll post information about the film at our website, capeandislands.org. Emma Green, Nelson Siegelman, Rob Morrison, thanks for being here. Really interesting conversation.
Yeah,
thank you so much. Coming up after a break, educating the public about red tides and toxic algae blooms. You're listening to The Point. We end the hour with a piece by Ari Daniel from his series Ocean Gazing. Here's Ari.
Hey, this is Ocean Gazing, and I'm Ari Daniel Shapiro. This was last episode's Sonic Stumper. It's the sound of shovels digging holes in a gravelly beach at the Indonesian community of Minahasa. Residents were planting mangrove trees to protect their shoreline from the possibility of a future tsunami. Today we'll discuss another coastal danger. It kills marine animals, contaminates shellfish, and aggravates asthma. And we'll find out what two scientists, Barb and Gary Kirkpatrick, are doing to help the situation. So stay tuned. Barb and Gary Kirkpatrick have been married for a long time.
We both started out in very different careers, and we've sort of morphed now into working down the hall from each other, which if you would have told me that 15 years ago, I would have just said, get out of here.
Yeah, she hit it right on the nail head there. We've ended up very close to the same same type of work.
To understand their story, we first have to understand harmful algal blooms and red tides.
Okay, the harmful algal bloom, or HAB, that's any event, marine or freshwater, anywhere in the world, that's caused by algae, aquatic algae, that grows up and creates a real thick mass of the stuff that we call pond scum. The Florida red tide is a specific species of algae that produces a harmful algal bloom in the Gulf of Mexico.
We'll return to that word harmful in a moment. Let's get back to the story of Barb and Gary.
Gary started out as an electrical engineer, and I started out as a respiratory therapist. And then I was teaching respiratory care at the local community college here in town. Part of my responsibility was going around to the local hospitals with my students doing their clinical rotations. And we were coming across these people in the hospital with asthma who were being told it was probably because of the red tide is why their asthma was triggered. And I remember going home and saying to Gary, so what's up with this red tide stuff and these aerosols?
Aerosols are materials that float around in the air.
And he said, you know, I don't think much research has been done about that that I know of. And that's sort of the beginning of where my interest got piqued.
Yeah, that was about the time that we had a federal grant to study the ecology of the red tide organism. So I was the lead scientist on several research cruises out in the Gulf. One of the things that I thought would be useful was, you know, let's look at how the scientists, how their health responds to working in and around the red tide on a daily basis. Barb being a respiratory therapist, I said, why don't you come along with us, do some respiratory measurements on us while we're working out there. Just a real informal thing. You know, there was just enough of a signal in a couple of scientists that really spurred her on, that she saw something was happening here. And she wanted to know more about it. She got involved. We got space for her on more cruises, and away it went.
And now both Barb and Gary Kirkpatrick are senior scientists at the Moat Marine Lab in Sarasota, Florida. Since those early days, they've learned a lot more. The Florida red tides are caused by a kind of tiny photosynthetic algae called Karenia brevis. These algae produce a chemical called brevetoxin, and it kills fish, turtles, and even marine mammals. Brevetoxin's got some human health impacts, too, including something called neurotoxic shellfish poisoning that causes gastrointestinal upset.
Commercially purchased shellfish is safe to eat. Where we caution the public and where we try to get the word out is for people who recreationally shellfish, and they need to know where there is red tide in the water so they don't harvest from that area.
Gary and a team have been working on a bunch of technologies that cruise the water on their own for weeks or months at a time. They scan for red tide by looking for particles that resemble Karenia brevis.
It alerts us. It tells us that it thinks there's a high likelihood that these red tide organisms are in the water. We have gotten to the point where we have 20 of these instruments deployed in a variety of locations, and they are reporting back to us on an hourly basis, letting us know what they see in the water.
This information is sent to the web where anyone can access it and avoid the beaches and waters contaminated with red tide. Brevetuxin can also become part of the marine aerosol or sea spray.
We then inhale it, and it becomes an irritant to our airways. And it causes kind of a classic irritating cough, nasal congestion, eye tearing. For the folks who have asthma, the story's a little bit different. With the asthma studies that we do, we measure lung function. And so we ask people to take as big and deep of a breath in as they can and blow it out hard and fast into this thing called a spirometer that measures both volume and the flow or the speed of the air that you're pushing out.
Barb and her undergrad, Elizabeth Moser, showed us how to use the spirometer.
Ready? Is it ready?
Exhale. It's ready. Exhale. Big deep breath in. Blow it out hard and fast. Blow, blow, blow. Keep blowing, keep blowing. Squeeze, squeeze. Keep blowing, keep blowing. Keep blowing. Squeeze, squeeze. Almost there. Keep blowing, keep blowing, keep blowing. And take a break. You did it!
I feel like I'm learning. I'm getting better.
You blew 4.42 liters. So if you think of a 2-liter bottle of Coke.
Oh, nice.
Barb's found that after an hour at a beach with aerosols produced by a red tide, people with asthma experience shortness of breath, wheezing, and tightness in their chest. And these symptoms last for 5 days.
And so it becomes really a public health concern to inform asthmatics when we have these blooms on our beaches.
And Barb's developed a system to do just that.
The high-tech part of it is that we have outfitted the lifeguards with BlackBerries or PDAs, and right from their lifeguard tower, they can put their report in on the conditions of their beach. It immediately goes into a web page with no human intervention, so that before you're leaving your house, you can check the 6 beaches of Sarasota County and the 2 public beaches of Manatee County and choose which beach that you want to go to on any particular day.
For each beach, the lifeguards report on the level of respiratory irritation, surf conditions, water quality, dead fish on the beach, and so on. Barb's found all sorts of people using this information.
One woman who looks at it to decide where she's going to do her Tai Chi every morning because she wants nice, serene, calm conditions. And so we created it for these harmful algal blooms, but what we're finding is people are using it for a whole variety of their own personal needs.
Here's one woman who has asthma, named Allison Peterson, who uses this system to find out about the beach conditions.
I have twin daughters that were 8 weeks premature and are prone to get bronchitis and that type thing, so we try and avoid the ocean when there is a red tide.
The Kirkpatricks work on projects professionally that help people like Allison Peterson and others make personal decisions. And it was the personal relationship of this wife and husband team that led them into professional collaboration in the first place.
It's great. I mean, you've got a colleague that you can sit and talk and you can throw ideas at anytime, anywhere. I mean, it does interfere a little bit with our home life if we're in the middle of dinner and all of a sudden an idea comes up. But we deal with it real well, and I'm glad we're doing it. It's wonderful.
Ocean Gazing is a product of the Centers for Ocean Sciences Education Excellence, and it's funded by the National Science Foundation. Special thanks to Lance Robson, Janice McDonald, Jim Yoder, and
Renoir Schweiter.
Music by Evan Sanders. That's all. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye.
That was Ari Daniel and a piece he produced for the series Ocean Gazing. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced.
produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.